I think the UK has taken a few batterings, but I think overall its reputation as a place to be an entrepreneur and to raise money and to sell businesses is still really strong. And there's a few key cornerstones that we have in the UK that are really important to that.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your business's spend without buying ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Elliot Gasper, and Elliot is based out of the UK, CFO there, and we are going to discuss today how the UK government has chosen to try and encourage entrepreneurialism in its country compared to maybe some of the others. So we're going to talk about, you know, historically, we all know the US is a home of the huge, big entrepreneurial successes. Europe has struggled with this. It's not a secret.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk a little bit about how the UK is approaching, you know, changing that a little bit. So Elliot, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you can kick us off by telling us something about you that not many of your colleagues would know.
James, it's great to be on. Thanks for having me. So something that people might not know, it feels like half a lifetime ago, because I think it literally was. As a kid, though, I was a national archery champion, of all things. So yeah, that's my little known fact that I like to talk about.
Very good. I love it. People who have achieved at a high level in sport, I think you can learn a lot from it. Is there anything that experience taught you that you use in your day-to-day today?
A lot of being good at any target sport is staying calm, right? Get your breathing right, get your heartbeat under control, and it will go better. And I think that still applies today. You know, I had a client once say, God, I wish we had you here for every crisis, because you always seem very calm every time we tell you about the next crisis. So I try and bring that every time.
Very good. And do you think I was a national champion for sport in Ireland, now admittedly. And
which sport? Don't keep it to yourself.
Okay, I was a judo champion, under 18 champion for judo.
Yeah.
Now, as they say here, I got manners put on me when the British Olympic team came to Belfast and I went up against them, and I quickly found out where I was in the pecking order. But in Ireland, I was a national champion for a while. And that really taught me that, hey, you know what? You can be the best at something. There's a lot of, you know, trophies for participation, etc., which is, you know, I'm fine, I guess. But there is something to be said for believing yourself as a winner. Do you think that had an impact of becoming a champion? Like, indefatigably,
yes,
you were the best and you knew you could be the best. And it's not often cool to talk about that this day and age. But do you think in the back of your mind that's influenced your confidence in yourself?
I think what it influences is being very realistic with yourself as to what you're good at and what your skills set is, right? So when I was a kid, I knew, yes, I can hit a target, right? But I mean, I was champion in my category, right? We take example of, no matter how good you are at something, somebody is better somehow, right? So even within my own family, my brother took it one step further, was invited to the GB archery squad tryout things, right? Which is a level I never got to. But what I do know from it is that there is skills that I have that I am good at and I can apply. And there's things that I am very bad at, which we might come on to discuss, right? I'm very bad at being an employee. I'm okay with that. I can reconcile the things I'm bad at and I can own that and I can really lean into what I'm good at. And I think that's what entrepreneurs should do, right? Here's where my skill set are. And I was reading in a lean marketing book. I don't know if anyone's read it, right? Their attitude is starve out your weaknesses and lean into your strengths.
Okay. Well, yeah, like you mentioned, entrepreneurs are often very bad at being employees. So, and you mainly work with entrepreneurs. So maybe that's a good fit. Maybe it's not a bad thing. However, everyone needs to get credentials, needs to get their start. How did you earn the right to call yourself a fractional CFO?
Yeah, it's a good and it's a long story, really. But if I had to break it down, it's having a knack of being in the right place at the right time and willing to solve the next problem. So how did I become CFO? Well, I'm a qualified SEMA accountant. I started actually in accountancy through a completely different route to the normal. So my degree is in computer science. I went to University of Hull, studied computer science, and realized I'm a terrible programmer, right? Again, leaning into things I'm not good at. I'm not a very good computer programmer. I could write code and I could make the computer do things. But what I realized during my degree is that lots of my friends were obsessed with it, right? That's what they lived and breathed to do, was computer programming. And we would finish a project on a Friday, right? And I'd have my, whatever it is, 120 lines of code that did this, whatever the project was. My friends would spend the weekend turning 120 lines of code into 40 lines of code. It did the same thing. The output was the same. It was just more efficient code. And they were very excited about that. And I didn't care. I was like, well, the code runs. It meets all of my requirements. It meets the business brief that we've been, you know, the fake business brief we've been given by our lecturers. It's done. So I came thinking, I don't have a life as a computer scientist, right? I'm not going to spend my weekend doing that. But I did always like the business side of our degree. And I remember finishing my final exam at university. My parents at the time lived in Oxford, so we were a long way from our university. So I finished my final exam. I packed up my car, packed up my house, was ready to move back home into my parents' house, and drove the 3.5 hours to get home to wander into the house. My father is also an accountant, right? So as I wandered into the house, having just finished university, thinking this was a big moment for me, blah, blah, blah. My dad is on the phone to a recruitment agent looking for his job, right? He was in the process of moving job at the time. I walk in the door while he's on the phone. He goes, oh, good. My son's just finished university and got home, you know, during the phone call, has just got home and finished university. Do you want to talk to him and see if you can find him a job as well? So he passes me the phone to this recruitment agent that I had no idea who this person was and whatever. And they said, oh, Elliot, nice to meet you. Do you have any skills in accounting? I said, no, none at all. I've heard of the name of a balance sheet. I think I know what that is. But my background is in data and analytics. Is that of any help? And what they had, again, being right place at the right time, this recruiter had been working with the University of Oxford to fill a central finance role, which was incredibly data heavy. It was a finance role, but it was very data heavy. And they really couldn't find any accountants that could replace the person who was leaving, because none of the accountants were good enough at the data side of the problem. So I was lucky that they decided to take a risk. And what they did was hire a person who could deal with the data side of the business of the role and teach them the accounting. And from there, sort of suddenly I found myself as a financial analyst and starting my accountancy degree sort of within 4 weeks of having driven back from university. There I was on another 3 years of study.
Very good. Yeah, I'm interested. I always assumed, I thought that, you know, programmers and accountants were kind of cousins, you know, spiritually when it came to, you know. However, I'm not so sure now that I've sort of gotten to know my cousins better now. Like, you know,
there's a little bit. Some accountants are very into chasing the last 10 pence around a balance sheet, right? They won't move on until every single penny is where it's at. And sometimes I think that's a bit like a computer scientist, right? They won't move on until every single line of code is as efficient as it can be. But that has never been my route. My route has always been quite a commercially focused accountant.
Okay. So that's in that first role, you kind of got the CIMA qualification kind of as an apprenticeship, was it, as you were working? Did they help you?
Yeah, apprentices didn't exist as they do now. Right in that. But yeah, they put me through my qualifications. So I went in at sort of the bottom rung of CIMA qualifications and spent the next three and a half years sort of studying for that while working full time at the university.
Okay. Tell me, in your career so far, where's the bulk of your experience come from?
The bulk of my experience is really leaning into commercial finance, right? So financial planning, financial analysis, communication. And a lot of that actually came from once I'd left higher education. So I had a great few years. I think in total, I spent about 5 years in various higher education institutes, got frustrated at the slow pace of these institutions and joined a startup called Conrad Energy, which is a UK-based flexible energy generation startup, private equity backed. Started back as an analyst, right, when I first joined them. And again, it was right time, right place. They had been very much struggling with putting together a good storytelling exercise, and really good finance and really good CFOs. What they're experts in is storytelling. You can leave other people to the, you know, double entry details of VAT returns. That's fine. What you really want to be good at as a CFO is storytelling. And again, that's what they were struggling with. They had all of this stuff, right? If you're a infrastructure, private equity backed infrastructure business. You've got a lot of potential cash available to you. You've got a lot of potential projects you could do. Each of those projects have their own cash flow forecasts. You've got a large team of people that need to design, construct, operate, and sell these things. There's a huge amount of data flowing around. And they were struggling to bring it all together into a decent financial model that could produce really good quality dashboards that could help them make decisions. So I joined Comrade to basically solve that problem for them, build them some very complicated three-statement models, and then support the CFO and their founder to work with the private equity house on what should we build, why should we build it, when should we build it, and how much is that going to cost, and how much return profit is that going to make.
And what sort of tooling did you use to pull that together? Was it all spreadsheets, or was there other...
Yeah. Interestingly, in the world, there is still not a better answer to this than Excel, right? You could spend hundreds of thousands of pounds putting in some tools like Anaplan, right? You could go crazy and spend a lot of money on some of these tools. And at the end of the day, Excel is still going to be what you're going to export it all to. So for still most of my career, we would natively start everything in Excel and bring it all together in that. And I would say there is a different level of Excel that exists. A lot of people will talk about, you know, I'm beginner, intermediate, advanced Excel user. There is a level of Excel that is sort of professional users of it, which can do all sorts of great. And I can bore you with stories of the things I've managed to get Excel to do for me, which are just, yeah, very useful.
My brother-in-law has a story about how he worked for one of the banks in London, and they used to go around, the new recruits would come in and they'd be given their computer and they'd be working in Excel all day long. And the joke was they go around and when mice had wires, they cut all the wires. And the idea was if you couldn't use Excel without a mouse, then you weren't a real analyst, you know.
It didn't count. Yeah. You do always get those sorts of stories. And I don't know how I feel about cutting the cord on the mouse. I used to make sure I always had two screens. And sometimes I get the accusation, how do you go from being really good at Excel to being a really good CFO? Aren't CFOs about strategy and blah, blah, blah? Which there's some truth to, but actually who I work for are high growth startups, right? That's what I support. And almost all high growth startups, regardless of industry, will go through problems of stitching all their data together. And actually what's holding back their ability to make decisions, their ability to tell stories, is the difficulty involved in bringing their CRM together with their payment provider, with their financial database, whatever it is. So having lived and breathed being a financial analyst for a lot of my career, I'm there to say, yes, you can stitch these things together. This is how we do it. Now, I don't spend a lot of my life actually doing that anymore, but I have seen how to do it, and I know how to do it, and I can get my team to build that for you.
So I'm always fascinated when people describe their job as telling stories, because I see on the one hand, the accounts are supposed to tell you the truth, right? And
yeah,
but then a story seems a lot more creative, and we've heard the expression, you know, creative accounting, which seems like, where's the line? Is there a line there? How do you know when you're telling a story versus, you know, selling a bill of goods? You know, like, do you start with the data and just tell it like it is? Or do you start with, we need to raise 600 million and let me go backwards from there?
Yes. As someone who has raised $600 million to date in my career, you start with the storytelling. Well, you start with both sides, right? You start with storytelling. What am I trying to say about this business? Okay, well, I want to tell a story about how we grow. What does that look like? How does this cash get used? In the end, it has to be backed up by double entry bookkeeping, right? Mm-hmm. At the end, there is a system somewhere keeping track of every penny, and it has to add up and it has to reconcile. Mm-hmm. But that is not the same thing as a presentation and a story. Accountants and lots of people joke about the power of EBITDA, right? Which you sometimes hear this term, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization, which is effectively a range to say, how do I define my EBITDA? And we move things around. So let's take the example of an agency business. Okay. An agency business might be responsible for booking advertising space on behalf of clients. So as a client to this agency, they'd say to me, hey, I need £100,000 to book this space for you, and we charge a 20% fee for managing that. Right. So I'm going to give them £120,000 in cash. The storytelling element, is that £120,000 worth of revenue, or is that £20,000 worth of revenue and £100,000 worth of somebody else's money? Now, the right answer is the second one. right? It's 20 grand worth of revenue, and it's 100 grand sitting on a balance sheet and moving through. But it's an example of, just because there's physically cash moving around doesn't mean all things are created equal. I've got a client at the moment who we are prepping the business for exit, right? And prepping a business for exit is all about really good storytelling. So we do quite a boring exercise on definitions. And you'd be amazed in a high-growth startup that people don't have a single definition of things. So what is a client is an interesting definition that I bet 80% of my clients, their team don't give me the same answer of what a client is. They don't have the same definition over what revenue is. What's your cost of sales? You know, you'll have stuff that the director's spending. You know, we've got a client at the moment where the director has got a car loan, it's quite an expensive car, it's quite a lot of hit on the P&L, but we're moving it below EBITDA, right? It's not something that anybody in the business has control over. It's not impacting their performance. It won't impact whoever buys the business, because it won't be their liability. And that's how we start to put the story together.
So the most famous quote on EBITDA is from Charlie Munger, and he calls it BS earnings, right? So he famously thought tough on it, if you like, because it can be abused, let's call it, right? So here's the name of the game. However, it's kind of the accepted, like everyone, especially in a growth business, you know, where it's all about EBITDA multiples, kind of, as long as you can find a bigger fool who's going to accept that same story? Isn't this all that matters? Or is that a cynical view?
No, I don't think that's... I try not to be cynical about it. What I try to do with my clients is make EBITDA relate to what it's supposed to tell us, which is, all things being equal, what is the profitability of this business? Okay. Now, what you should never do is trust anybody who can't give you... So we would sometimes call it adjusted EBITDA, right? If they can't give you a reconciliation of the adjustments you've made, then don't trust them, because they're hiding something, right? They're hiding something you don't want you to see. But if you can keep a record of what I'm adjusting for. So for example, we used to do this in our private equity backed startups all the time. Yeah. They would ask us for an adjusted EBITDA number that gave us the realistic view of just, if everything was running normally, what is the profitability of the business? So we would take out, have we dismissed staff and given them a payout, right? That's a one-off event. Doesn't belong in our everyday running costs. We take it out of EBITDA. Like this car thing, right? If we're paying for someone's car, that's not the ongoing cost of running this business. We remove it from EBITDA. But we would have this record of it all the time. And it helps us tell the story of, this is the underlying value of the business.
So that's a good example. Like, so, you know, the director's car doesn't come under, you know, earnings before interest, was it tax, depreciation, and amortization? It's none of those things. And yet... it gets put under, you know, under that line. Okay, right. So that's where you call it adjusted EBITDA, I guess.
It's an adjusted EBITDA. But that's not the only bit of storytelling, right? When we say storytelling, we don't always mean just how we choose to present the financial statements. What we often mean, and I see this all the time, and even after many years and many grey hairs later of looking at financial statements, I still get people that will say, here's our board pack, and they'll just give me a flat file of just a P&L statement, right? It's got 55 lines in it. They all say something and there's a bunch of stuff. Even I can't read that and tell you anything about the business, right? It's just a meaningless file. So the storytelling is, how do I lay information on top of that, right? And my if I say, here's my profit and loss statement, I don't have to present just financial data. So where's our customer? How many customers have we onboarded? How many have churned? What did we do in marketing? What was our pay-per-click, average pay-per-click for this campaign? We start to layer metrics at the top of the report, so that when I see, oh, okay, we've got £2 million extra income this quarter, I can immediately start to see why, because actually I can see my increase in customers and I can see my increase in pay-per-click advertising, which has driven those increased customers. And now I can give you a story of, hey, James, this is why you're earning £2 million more.
Yeah. Okay. So cool. So let's talk a little bit about how the UK has chosen to try and incentivize its entrepreneurs. And this is something you need a CFO to know the ins and outs of, and someone who's aware of all the incentives that are available. And then we're going to talk a little bit about a client, how you're helping with maximizing this opportunity in particular. So give us a high level first of, you know, what's the UK philosophy. In the US, it's pretty much the Wild West. Those guys, the entrepreneurs, get huge tax rebates. Seems like they never pay any tax at all if you start a business. And then you can, when you die, you give it to your kids tax-free, more or less, you know, up to a huge limit as well. Yes. In Europe, it's very different. So give us a high level of what this philosophy is when it comes to taxation and entrepreneurship in the UK.
Yeah, I think the UK has taken a few batterings, but I think overall its reputation as a place to be an entrepreneur and to raise money and to sell businesses is still really strong. And there's a few key cornerstones that we have in the UK that are really important to that. So we have schemes like what's called SEIS and EIS schemes, which are tax relief for investors. So an amazing ability to say, if you're an early stage startup, and we define early stage in these schemes, so SEIS, which is the smaller scheme, you know, you're earning your first £250,000, you're in the first 3 years of your trading life. If you invest into that business, that investor will get up to 50% income tax relief on the year they invest. And when they go on to sell the business, they'll sell it free of capital gains tax. If the business goes on to fail, they'll get even more income tax relief. It's bigger brother, EIS, works in the same way, but you sort of, instead of 50%, you get 30% relief, but you can raise up to 12 million under that scheme for your company. And those sorts of schemes, and there's various versions of this. There's business asset disposal relief available for entrepreneurs. There's gift holdover relief. There's growth shares. There's EMI shares. There's all of these schemes that have been put together as a way to incentivize through tax relief the investment and growth of early stage businesses.
So let me try and just throw a lot at me there. So let me just get this right. So what I heard there when you're investing, say I choose to invest in a pre-approved company, which is a key thing we're going to talk about. So we're going to, then I get 50% back on my income tax, or, and then if that company goes bankrupt, I get the other 50%. Is that what I heard right?
You don't get the full other 50%, but you get further relief. So actually for about every £1 you risk, you're actually risking 30 pence at the end of the day, right? And that's how they're incentivizing it. So these are really good schemes. And those are two schemes that exist for investors. There are share schemes that exist for employees. So that's where I was mentioning that term EMI. That's an employee share scheme where they can get a part of the business for great tax benefits.
Right.
And there's employers benefits. Sorry, there's founders benefits as well, which are the things like business asset disposal relief. Now, what you may or may not know, in the UK, that's been sort of made worse and worse, but it's still there, right? You still get up to your first million as your disposal tax-free, which I think sometimes as founders, and I count myself as my own founder trying to grow my own agency here, and I've grown different businesses before, we sort of are lulled into this false sense that we somehow deserve all of our money to be tax-free, right? For some reason that we just should have that. And we sort of forget that there are still amazing tax incentives in the UK. And someone's telling you, you can have millions of pounds tax-free out of this. And somehow we're still all complaining about that. But anyway, maybe don't put that in the podcast. But
well, I guess if I were to say, I try and complain about it for a second. In Ireland, for example, you have entrepreneurs relief. Basically, if you dispose of your business, you get the first million tax at 10%.
Okay, so you've got the same one.
Similar type of thing. I guess that, and one argument is, well, income is income. You know, if you're working a job, you pay 50%, then why wouldn't you pay less than 50%, more or less, you know, for any other type of income? What makes capital different? And this is kind of a socialist argument, I guess. But an entrepreneur might say, well, you know, an entrepreneur might have, you know, 10 or 15 years building up a business, maybe not very much income at all and huge risk. And then they have suddenly all their income in 1 year. And suddenly, you know, they have to pay 50% on that in the 1 year versus someone else may have earned that same money over 20 years and only paid an effective rate of 30%. So I could see the argument for allowing entrepreneurs, and obviously I would say this, to have more incentive for it. So yeah, I get that. And is that, let me ask the question, is this changing at all? Because this sounds very similar how it is in the EU and the rest of Europe. So has Brexit given any opportunities, or has there been any, is it better being an entrepreneur in the UK? Has it given them any more latitude? Because oftentimes here we hear about how in Ireland, oh, we'd love to do more for entrepreneurs, but there's these European frameworks and, you know, we can't be seen to be giving people unfair advantage, blah, blah, blah. So has there been a Brexit?
I don't, Yeah, has there been a Brexit dividend, if any have ever existed? I mean, I don't purport to be sort of a leading expert on
Sure.
UK economy, but what I can tell you is that SEIS and EIS schemes were improved in the last year or two, right? The limits of those were doubled in some cases.
Right.
So clearly we're taking seriously wanting to incentivize investors to be here in the UK. Yes, things like business asset disposal relief, which used to be called entrepreneurs relief, is getting a little bit worse over time. And yet we are still, outside of the US, the place to raise money and to sell your business, to list your business, followed probably by Paris, maybe places like Portugal, right?
Okay, and I guess, London's strength in the financial markets is part of that, that a lot of capital comes into the UK and then, you get to take advantage of that. But there's a catch. There's always a catch, right? So in Ireland here, so long as you're not a property investment or a stock, basically investment company or a holding company, you'll be good to go. You can get that entrepreneur's relief. However, you do have to get pre-approved. Tell me about what you, in order to take advantage of these schemes, you have to get pre-approved. And this is where I guess someone might need someone like yourself. And like you tell me here how, maybe tell me why, having a CFO from the start can help you set yourself up for success with these schemes.
Yeah, so it's a really important question, and it's a big debate that goes on, right? So, all of those schemes, the majority of the schemes I've just mentioned, all involve HMRC, some of them from the very first part, right? So, you have to do what's called advanced assurance on SEIS and EIS tax relief, which means you're either going to have to do the application yourself, you're going to have to bring in a CFO, or you're going to have to bring in some sort of advisor to put these applications in and maintain them and make sure you're compliant. And like anything to do that's government regulated, there are rules and structures and ways to make better use of it and ways that it can all go wrong. And the UK is littered with stories of investors who thought they were going to get tax relief. And unknown to them, the entrepreneur has made some sort of decision that has invalidated their SEIS relief. And suddenly the investor is not going to get the tax relief they thought they were going to get. And that is a difficult conversation to have with your shareholders. Terribly sorry, but we restructured the company incorrectly, and now you're going to lose all your tax relief, and there's nothing we can do about it. So you do have to tread carefully
Well, what are the
on
big
those
mistakes
things.
people can make there?
So you have to be compliant for the full 3 years, right? So one big question I get asked a lot by my clients is, should I incorporate in the US as well? I've got my business in the UK. I think my next place to go is the US. I'm going to create a US top co and start to raise money. Right. Now, entrepreneurs are famous for moving quickly. So they might have this idea on Monday morning, they're sort of incorporating by Wednesday afternoon. But you can't, your UK company can't be a subsidiary of another company. Otherwise, it's no longer compliant. And without meaning to, they've moved really quickly. They haven't taken advice. They haven't spoken to anybody. And now they've lost their SEIS or EIS compliance for it. Or they've taken on subsidiaries that are doing other things that aren't qualifying trades and they've lost their compliance. So I've got a client at the moment who we're working at the early stages. They are a veterinary multi-site business, or they're going to be, right? They're early planning stages. First thing we've done for them is build a really great three-statement financial model, because if you're going to build locations, if you're going to take on that much capital, we would advise that you get a three-statement model. Now, normally, if you're like a SaaS business, some sort of tech business, and you're early stage, you don't need a three-statement model. You need a good quality cash model, because you can do the business plan on cash. We built them this lovely model. We've decided how it is we're going to build them up. They've really taken it to heart, really used that model to really plan out their business, which is great. That's what you should be doing. The next step is, okay, we now want to start raising money. If you're a UK-based business and you want to start raising money, you better get SEIS and EIS, advance assurance from HMRC. Sensibly, they've spoken to me first, because one of the founders was going to do it through their holding company, right? They were going to set up the business, they were going to hold the shares under their holding company, because that sounds sensible. Apart from, you can't do that and be compliant with SEIS. Again, it can't be a subsidiary of another company. So you have to hold the shares personally as the entrepreneur. So they were able to get that advice. They're bringing me on to now do their full SEIS, EIS application, which isn't a huge amount of work. A little bit of work is just knowing the government website, knowing how to answer the questions, knowing how to phrase things in the right way. And we can get them that, and they can go and start raising their first tranche of money.
Great. So tell me a bit more about how, I mean, this client, what are you're helping with the building stages as well. What type of business have they got in mind, and where did they get the experience to be able to do this in the first place?
Yeah, these are two individuals who I would call real founders, right? They're real entrepreneurs. They've got experience in the sector. They've done private equity backed vet care before. They know what that looks like and how that operates. And now they're setting up to do it themselves. They are going to do any sort of multi-site play. So if I have a specialism, and I always say my specialism is high growth businesses, because actually industry to industry, it doesn't hugely matter. It's the growth stage. But if I did have an industry, it's infrastructure and that heavy asset businesses, of which this would count, right? Because I'm going to have to take out a whole bunch of leases. I'm going to have to do a whole bunch of fit out. I need to buy medical equipment. I need to buy expensive medical equipment. I need to have stocks of drugs, right? There's a large capital requirement in this business. And there's a lot that's going to sit on your balance sheet and a lot of potential value on that as well. So that's what they're going to open one or two locations with money from early investors, which will be high net worth individuals, angel syndicates, whatever it might be. That will allow them to open their first few locations. We can get that value onto the balance sheet, and that will open doors on, okay, where does the next bit of money come from? I've now proven as an entrepreneur, and these guys will do this. I believe in them. They are very clearly very good operators. They will open these sites, start to show traction, start to have things on their balance sheet that they can then leverage. So actually their next rollout of what might be 10 sites, part of that can be backed by debt. Part of that can be backed by private equity, and you can see how that starts to scale from there.
Okay, that's interesting, because for these roll-up strategies, I've heard people say, well, it's good to have an asset-light business, like typically in the US, it's like a HVAC business. All you need is a van, some tools, and a couple of bodies, warm bodies to go do the work, and you're in business straight away, right? Whereas here, you're saying, well, maybe it's an advantage to be capital intensive, which isn't typically what you'd think of. But what's the advantage there of having all this? A, you need all the capital to buy the stuff in the first place. And what's the advantage of being so asset heavy for later from a strategy perspective?
From a strategy perspective, pure and simply, asset heavy businesses can leverage debt. It's much easier to leverage debt, right? Because there's something that the bank can put a floating security or a security on.
Okay.
And that means I don't have to give up all of my equity to raise the cash. The other way, if you're a tech business or something, you could leverage debt once you're big enough and once you've got enough invoice financing that you can do. I'm going to remember, not all businesses, some businesses are asset businesses, right? So we take the HVAC example. That's probably a little bit light, but actually if you want 100 HVAC engineers, are you going to have 100 vans? Are you going to have 100 sets of tools?
Sure.
Are you going to have to start doing a warehouse to store all these things? Right, it starts to build up. Now, I work with a lot of SaaS companies. I work with a lot of different things, but there are still real opportunities for asset-heavy businesses. Right, I had a great client a couple of years back who are developing eco solutions for what they call the final mile of delivery. Right, we sort of, as a tree, they're very good at decarbonizing most of the delivery infrastructure, but actually that last mile that it has to get to your house is done by large vans, you know, enterprise rentals floating around. And here they are, they're trying to build electric bikes that are cargo fitted. And that's an asset. That's a really interesting asset heavy business. The UK is fantastic at electric vehicles. The UK is really good at all sorts of things that are going to require intensive capital, which is a little bit slower. And I think that's why people are put off, right? Because there's more planning involved. There's more serious cash to be discussed. You are more likely to bring on a fractional CFO at an earlier stage if you're an asset-heavy business, because there is just more going on that you have to get right as well.
Okay, so I guess it's easier to attract investment as well if the investors feels like there is something backing the asset there. So from the EIS scheme, that is debt.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not really debt, that's equity, but you're...
Yeah.
I guess the dog whistle on a lot of these schemes, I don't know about how it is there, but over here, if you're running an EIS scheme, you're kind of being the bank. You can kind of set the terms a lot more than you might through, let's say, professional investors. Because, you know, if I have EIS scheme, I'm, you know, raising money from dentists and lawyers and, you know, it could be anyone really.
Yes.
Yeah, right. So you get to define a slightly better term than you might from a bloodthirsty venture firm, let's say.
Yeah, so I do sessions, I do talks. I'm quite passionate on knowledge sharing, right? So I do quite a lot of events. And I did one recently where I talk about what are the different types of investors that you can go to, right? Because the number of times I still talk to people who you think are sounding really sensible, and yet they'll join a call with me and they'll say, I've not built anything. I'm still putting my pitch deck together, but I thought I'd raise 8 million today or this year so that I don't have to bother raising again, right? From a VC. And you think you're going to, right? You aren't going to raise 8 million from a VC as your first bout of money with nothing built, with no customers, no traction. And they've completely misunderstood the UK fundraising landscape. And actually, the majority of your first money, like you said, will come from high net worth individuals who are just interested in what you're doing. So that might be lawyers, dentists, whatever, right? This client of mine that's doing the vet thing, it's likely their first tranche of money will come from individuals who have a background in veterinary practices, backgrounds, and have seen this before. But the good thing of that is they're individuals, right? They have their own reasons to invest. They have their own standard way that they would like to invest. They have their own sort of experience, and it's their own money. Now, that is a good thing and a bad thing, because, like I said, you might get better terms. You can have more individual deals. On the other hand, it's their own money, so they might have their own sort of rules and regulations they put in place, or those left field requests that you wouldn't get. And as you step up from sort of angels to angel syndicates, that's where you start to get rules come into place. Yes, we're angels, but actually, as a syndicate, we only invest in northeastern UK businesses, or we only invest in ed tech businesses. But step up from that, you start to get to VCs, right? And VCs are investing other people's money. It is not their money. And what a large section, I think, of entrepreneurs don't understand is that it's important to recognize that it's other people's money. And therefore, VCs are legally required to invest in what they said they would invest in. And so, no, they're not just going to break the rules this once because your idea is super good.
Right, I see. So you mentioned the networking that you've invested quite heavily in, and I believe this has been a key to part of your practice's success. And you run an event, I believe, in Oxford. Is that right? Tell us a bit about that for professional CFOs.
Yeah, so I think in the UK, as a fractional CFO industry, it's still relatively young, right? A sort of few years old, I'd say, as a really an understood industry. And what you get is there are quite a lot of fractional CFO communities around. In my experience, most of them are run by recruitment companies. They're really nice communities still, right? They're great groups. There's some good events, but they're run by recruitment agents for probably obvious reasons as to why they're doing that. But what there wasn't was a fractional CFO community run by a fractional CFO. So in January of this year, we launched the Fractional Finance Forum, which is aimed at any fractional finance professional. So the majority of us are CFOs, but we've got fractional accountants, fractional bookkeepers. It's not really aimed at just sort of accountancy practices. It's those who are really working with a handful of clients at a time. And it's a space for us to sort of set knowledge, admit the things that we don't know. I think as accountants, we're still a professional career, so we're expected to look professional and act professional and have an answer to everything. So it can be difficult to put your hand up and say, actually, I don't know this thing. Can somebody talk to me about it? So it's a community for that, basically. Mostly run off WhatsApp and online events, but we're going to looking at this year of hosting our first in-person events, which will be breakfast roundtables. We're looking at an afternoon event in Oxford. Hope to get sort of Oxford Ventures and Oxford Capital involved as well in that. I'm really looking forward to bringing all that together.
And has that been a source of customers for you thus far?
It's been a really good source of actually how do you grow a fractional CFO agency? Because actually, what we all have is different backgrounds and skills, right? So, my background happens to be in more asset heavy businesses, as we discussed. I don't have a huge background in e-commerce selling to Europe, right? I know the rules. I couldn't go and implement it for you, but actually, there's another fractional CFO in the group who can. So, what we can do is bring that resource in to our agency to service that customer, and we can put it in the community. Hey, you've got this client coming on board. This is their problem. Who here has experience in that? Do you want to come on board and do it for us? And that way, hopefully, we'll grow a really successful agency with a flexible workforce to it as well. And we get people in there doing this between themselves, right? This isn't just my way of getting a we'll shout that sentence again. Isn't just my way of getting resource from a community. They're actually sharing resources between each other's as well, which is great to see.
Congratulations.
About 110 of us in the group so far. It's been a really good community as well.
Well, congratulations. If you, nothing against recruitment agents, but if you can keep them out, it's not 10 CFOs and 90 recruitment agents, then you're fine. That's not happening, you're fine.
No, I say nothing against them. I really enjoy working with those recruitment agencies, but I think there is a space for a community run by its own people, right?
Very good. All right. So listen, this has been cool. And maybe you can wrap it up by telling us who should reach out to you, ideally, and how can they do that?
Yeah. So who should reach out to us? If you are, we find ourselves as helping you make decisions, right? If you're a high growth UK based business, you're scaling from, you know, to your first million, 10 million in revenue. You're starting to think, I need to raise capital and you'll to grow and expand aggressively. That's who we support. If you're an SME who's thinking, actually, I'm quite happy with my turnover at the moment, I don't really want to grow my business, I'd just like to file my taxes a bit better, that's not us. Don't come to me and ask me about that. If you want to know how to grow, if you want to know how to use data to improve your decision making, then please come and talk to us. We'll be able to support you. And they can reach out on LinkedIn. I'm active on LinkedIn. They can reach out over WhatsApp. I'm sort of, contact details are not hidden. I think you should be able to get hold of me quite easily.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks very much, Elliot. It's been fun. And thank you for listening. Your special reward for coming this deep into the podcast with us is be able to sign up for our newsletter at procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Now, why would I want to sign up to your newsletter, James? I hear you think. Well, there's a couple of good reasons. We've discovered the secret to getting people to reading our newsletter, which is to review this past week's examples of waste, fraud and abuse that have happened in the news from around the world. Sometimes it's Naomi Campbell and her charity, the Climate Cropper, and was sending people around the world on first class flights when they should have been supporting nascent fashion artists and their careers. Sometimes it's local government and municipalities who just didn't follow the rules or outright took advantage of the rules. And sometimes it's small businesses which just make everyday mistakes that have led to them ending up in trouble. Anyway, for our viewing pleasure and vicarious interest, if you like, on how not to do it, you can find out some examples. And maybe along the way, you'll learn a thing or two about how to run a better business that protects yourself against some of these mistakes. We also have updates on podcasts like this. So you get, if you're interested in this podcast, you can sign up at procurementexpress.com/newsletter. So congratulations, you've earned the right to sign up, Elliot, you included. And thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, James. It's been great.